Welcome back to another episode of Work in Programming. This week, I'm joined by Josh Cunningham. Josh, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you be able to give your quick introduction?
My name is Josh. I've been programming for close to 15 years, probably 14 or so. I'm self-taught, so I started off in chemistry. I was on the track to become a medicinal chemist. Started programming as kind of an elective. They had just one of those classes you take to sort of fill requirements, and it was a Java class, and Java's not particularly inspiring, but I really liked how, I liked the really fast return, right? So you can write programs and you get a response pretty quickly. Java, you have to compile, but compared to chemistry, it's a lot faster. So I kind of stuck with that and started to build websites and do design and SEO and kind of did that whole like site builder route. I'm sure that many of us have been on before, where you're like, oh, people will pay me more than they probably should to make these sites, and that's fine. So I did that for a long time and worked for an agency for a short bit, but mostly was freelance. And then I joined Auth0 about 3 years ago, just over 3 years ago, and got into the identity and security space, which I'm enjoying quite a bit, both the company and the space. I live near Seattle and I have two young kids. One is 8 and one is 4, almost 8 and 4.
So when you were freelancing and then moved into an agency, like how did that process get started for you? So you learned Java and then you started web development at some point. Did you start by like building yourself a site, or were you like working with some friends or somebody who just needed a site? Or
yeah, I'm going to correct you. I didn't learn much Java. I I survived a quarter of it and never again touched it. But I liked the logic part of it. But yeah, the site building stuff, it kind of started as a website for my stepdad. Actually, he was a counselor, and he knew that he should be on the web. And so I started to learn the whole HTML, CSS thing, and then kind of pretty quickly got into PHP. And by PHP, I mean, you know, like simply includes to make your life easier across pages. That was the long and the short of it at that time. And then made a site for myself and started to say, I can kind of put myself out there as somebody that does this stuff. And I was reading Seth Godin at the time. He was very, very popular then, still, you know, a great person to listen to and read. And he said something about like a digital coach. He said, I wish we had this idea of like a digital coach where someone would come in that knows all this stuff and would teach people how to do it. So they would teach folks how to, you know, set things up and be on the web and be kind of a technological citizen. I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. So I kind of put myself out there as that. And that at the time consisted of basically a Craigslist ad that was like, I'll help you with your digital life or whatever. I hope I have a copy of that somewhere that'd be interesting to read. But I was in San Diego at the time and I put this out there and really quickly got a response. Someone got back to me and said, hey, I need some help setting up some printers. And I was like, okay, yeah, all right, that falls under that umbrella. And I kid you not, so this is my very first client, and I go there, very, very nice man. His name was Harry Katz, K-A-T-Z, Harry Katz. And he had two very long-haired hairy cats, and their hair was everywhere. So as I'm routing cables through like hairballs behind things. And I, as soon as I left, very nice guy, paid me well. I was like, I'm not sure this is exactly what I had in mind or Seth Godin that he had in mind with a digital coach. So I tuned a little more towards the web space and just started to pick up folks that needed stuff out there, like an artist. And then she referred me to an art rep of hers. And then she referred me to somebody else. And it kind of started that way. I was doing it on the side, and I believe I was finishing up my chemistry degree there, and I was also working part-time for a marketing company, and then I built their site. It kind of just snowballed from there.
That's really cool that you started with just a Craigslist ad. I tried that when I first got into web development. I think it was a bit saturated, but like whenever I did it, it was like somebody more or less like looking for like an IT guy to like join their company, and like they're hiring like freelancers, but they would just kind of like ping them and be like, look, like we need somebody to work in house, we'll pay you minimum wage or whatever. But anyway, from Craigslist to like building your marketing agency's website and to like building up a client base, like did you then get into freelancing Or did you go to the agency like relatively that built into more of like a long-term career? Like when did you decide to like take that as your full-time career?
So the agency came as I was full-time freelancing, and I ended up doing that full-time pretty soon after I was working for a software company and doing their kind of like market, like I learned how to do emails and things like that. And I think I was able to find enough clients during that time that I was able to transition pretty quickly to freelance. I would say after a year and a half, I was part-time at this company anyway. So it was, I had a fair amount of time to do that. Ended up just hustling, really, you know, more than anything. My dad also, actually, I think that probably helped too, is my dad is a financial consultant, an independent financial consultant. So he knew lots of businesses that kind of like might've needed some help here or there, but most of it was really word of mouth. Yeah, it was, I'm trying to think of exactly the path I took there, but I just ended up with enough clients that it made sense. And then ended up joining an agency a ways after that. I was probably 6 years in or so, and just did it kind of for a change of pace, but also I had it in my head that I really wanted to build an agency. I really wanted to, you know, hire people. I would contract out to stuff. I'd contract out to designers, and I'd contract out to a friend of mine. And I kept thinking about it like a bigger thing. I really wanted to run something. And so I joined an agency, and what you kind of learn, at least I learned from this agency, is that the same problems you have as a freelancer are identical in an agency. They're just bigger and harder. So that same like that linear connection to income where you're like, if I want to make more, I can charge more, but only up to a certain point. After that, it's more working hours, right? There's no multiplier. Like if I start a product, there's a multiplier there. If it catches on, then it can be one person maintaining a lot more sales. But in the agency sense, you really are, you know, time money. You're trading time for money. Just depends on how much money you're trading it for. And I guess, I don't know why I thought it would be different at an agency than freelance, but I just found the same problems were there. And so I left there feeling kind of like, oh gosh, you know, what am I going to do? I don't think I can do much more freelancing. And then I did freelance for like another 3 or 4 years, I think, before I joined Dotzero.
Which I feel like that's because it, I mean, I don't know if you found this, but like I had like a similar path coming out of an agency and then joining Dotzero. I found it like, it seemed really hard to me to move from freelance agency work, like that sort of like client services into product. Not like that it was necessarily like, I mean, there's obviously the big transition of the job and we can get into some of that. Like it's a huge learning curve. My point was like, did you find it hard to find did people that you interview with think like, okay, well, you know, you haven't done product work, like are you capable of doing that? Like have you encountered that at all?
I had a chemistry degree, which I may have passed for, you know, okay, he had some math, he, you know, got through some of that. So that might have helped a little bit, but yeah, I interviewed at quite a few places. I've always been terrible at whiteboarding, you know, coding in person stuff. So that really worked against me. I was rejected over and over from multiple different companies. And I was fairly picky. I wasn't applying everywhere, but you know, you apply at Stripe and Stripe wasn't going to hire me at that time. You know, especially with the skills I had over pair programming, it was so hard for me to do that. So I felt like it was kind of a long shot, but at Auth0, the position that they were hiring for was PHP and WordPress, which I mean, I'd been doing that for many, many years. And really, it was kind of my primary language, PHP was. And I'd done so much WordPress that it kind of just fit really well. And then the project was a sort of a WordPress plugin to kind of make that work better with Auth0. So it really, it was like the perfect thing for me to show I knew what I was doing. But, you know, they asked for unit tests. And I was like, I didn't write unit tests for clients. I really had to figure that out. You know, I knew the concept. I knew, you know, how to do it. I've written a few tests before. But getting into there, I'm like, I don't know what to test. I'm not sure. What would I do? And, you know, after a year or so working the plugins was like, you know, 70% tested. I learned from the team around me, right? So, but getting back to your original question, yeah, definitely. I felt like I had basically 10 years of experience, but I was writing code like someone with maybe 2 or 3 years, you know, and it hit me really hard on that team too when I joined. again, around testing, I wasn't really clear on how this works, how that worked. One of our teammates, Luciano, really helped me in that aspect, kind of essentially teaching me how to do it and showing me, like, you don't test that way, you test this way. So that first year was, I learned so much, so much. I had a lot to learn there.
I like that. I really like that. I wrote tests at an agency, but I feel like it was always like, like just to prove that we were writing tests, I feel like in some cases, like most of the time the focus is just like deliver. It's like even if you get a good client that like is down with that sort of thing, they're still like, they're expecting to live with a certain amount of technical debt. It's more like get the work out the door. And if you can deliver things quickly and reliably, then that's great. And it doesn't matter if it's like they're not thinking about keeping this thing running for the next 5 years. Whereas Auth0, like we're working with like it's like developers consuming this, so people are gonna try and do their own things with it, and it needs to be very like clear. Otherwise, they're just gonna abandon it, right? And then to be working on the SDK team is like, I feel like that's the heart of it, right? Like you're joining that team, like you're working with the community to figure out how the product should work or like is working, but you're also like working with like you're kind of like at that like that barrier, if we're talking about like testing a boundary, like you're at that boundary, and that's like, I feel like that must be an interesting just experience in general.
Yeah, absolutely. We call that in onboarding bridging the gap, right? We want to do as much as we possibly can for customers to make it easy, but at some point you are going to have to integrate an application with this process. So it was interesting starting there because I was basically a consumer of the product, right? So I'm using Auth0 just like anybody else would use it. And it was kind of an interesting perspective. But getting back to what we were saying about testing, I think what happens with agency, especially with on the engineering side, it probably happens a lot on the designer side, on the design side as well. But if you go out and hire an agency to do in-depth engineering because you don't have that staff at your company, well, you don't really understand the whole software development life cycle. You don't have that competency. So unless, which is really rare, but unless you hire an agency and you're just like, hey, blank check, we trust you, build it the best way, which I've literally never seen happen, you're gonna have the engineers, regardless of how good they are, they're not going to get really good at the stuff that matters on a product team. It's really hard to sell tests to a client because they don't get it, They don't want to pay for that. It's just more software that doesn't run. Well, it'll be less bugs. Just make it without bugs in the first place, right? They don't have an engineering culture to really understand why that kind of stuff is important, and trying to convince them out of the blue to spend more money on something that's, for them doesn't have a real tangible benefit. That's a really tough place to be in. And especially if you really love engineering, you can find yourself after you've learned as much as you can for client stuff and all the different frameworks and stuff, and you find, I want to go a little deeper, or I want to go back and refactor that. Oh, we don't have the budget for that. Well, I really want to work on this. No, you're not going to work on that. It runs really contrary to, in my opinion, or at least in my experience, it runs really contrary to going deep and learning more as an engineer.
And I think like most of the actual like meat of development, the stuff that like matters comes after deployment, right? Like I've found that like doing agency work, like we were basically take a product from like zero to launch really quickly and just keep doing that over and over again. So you kind of like, all right, you get the process down, you know how like you can kind of learn the framework if you're sticking within a framework. And if you're working with startups like as like a staff aug type of thing, I think you can like that's kind of where I found that, they did not have a development process, but it was like they were like looking to extend like add a few extra hands, but that maybe isn't really traditional agency work as much. So I think like that's kind of like the iteration cycle. I think the way Charity Majors put it was like you're basically like you're writing the first chapter of the book over and over again, and then you're not, finishing the novel, you're just moving on to the next next book.
Totally. And I could get why that's fun for folks. And I don't want to be like gatekeeping on real engineering or anything like that. That's really not how I meant it. I think if you like to go from thing to thing to thing and you get bored with something and you want to be really, really general, or you get a lot more fun out of the customer interaction or client interaction in that case, then it's a perfect fit. But I think some folks will really, like myself, want to go deeper and spend more time on a library, on a service, and say, I want to make this better and I want to go deeper and learn this stuff more. And that's, as soon as you start to get that feeling, it's like freelance agency is just not going to fit.
In that first year, like, what were some of the biggest changes? So you said, like, I forget the name.
Luciano.
Luciano. So Luciano taught you a lot about testing. Like, what were some of the principles that you think, like, changed that from, you know, oh, I have this idea of, like, what a test is, you know, I want input, output. I know how to, like, A plus B should equal 4, but then, you know, there's, like, that, and then there's, like, testing actual applications.
Yeah, that's I've written like probably three draft posts on this and never finished them because it just got so long. So if I start rambling on for too long, you can tell me to shut up. But I think the first part you start with, at least I started with, coverage, right? So trying to get as much coverage as possible, right? Because it's for me, I didn't really understand. I understood that it was supposed, what it was kind of supposed to do. It's supposed to run this code. So if something changes, then a test breaks, but I didn't really understand, some things need deeper testing, or like this idea of sometimes you write the test first or not, the TDD thing, like it works in some cases and not in others. I find TDD works really well if you're fixing a bug. You write a test for the bug, then you fix the bug. That's great. That's a workflow that makes perfect sense. It makes me write better code. But I think what I got really caught up in is as soon as I started to mock things, is like you just mock all the things. And I found myself writing almost like more testing code than application. It's just mocks and mocks and mocks. And I thought, this does not make a lot of sense. And even Lucho was like, I think you're going a little too far in that. You're going a little crazy on that. And in a desire to do coverage, you can, PHP lets you mirror methods and then turn them to public. So you like turn on private methods and test them. So I thought, oh, this is great. I'm writing tests for every line, every method. I preferred big, like big long tests with all these expects. And what I learned over time is really like understanding what you're testing for. There's some stuff that you really want to test for, regex expressions that are supposed to prevent a certain thing or are supposed to do a certain thing, or functions that convert. And then I also, it really changed how I wrote code. Like you really start writing code to be testable. And I thought that seems so ridiculous when I started writing tests. Like, why would you write code for a test? That's a weird way to architect something. And you start to find like, oh, those little smaller functionalities. I was used to writing WordPress hooks, right? 500 line functions, 1,000 line functions that do all this logic when a certain thing happens, like in an e-commerce platform or something like that. So it really changed how I wrote code and started to get me to understand, yeah, okay, you do want to test the private method, but do it in a bigger way, and test for real world scenarios. Don't go crazy on minute use cases, and smaller expect statements, one per, things like that. That took a long time, even this year, it still feels like every day you're learning something a little bit new about how to write tests that are maintainable and not brittle, and that document the code. On the SDK side, I realize as you're writing those tests, you're writing the code that customers are writing. So pick up on that. If that method name doesn't make sense in your code, in your test code, it's not going to make sense on someone else's side either. So I learned a lot about coding through that for sure.
I like that because even like the point about like you're writing your code that your clients are going to use or like your customers are going to end up using, it's like I feel like that's a good like litmus test for like is this like a good like maybe more like higher sometimes higher level test, but like it's like a good litmus test is like does this look like the implementation? Like if I'm writing a React component, it's like you know really I should just if it's like this is how it'd be used in the product, it's like I've got a component, I pass in props, and then I do something and these various effects happen. Your test can just assert that. And then it really does end up looking like you're just like you're rendering out some code or you're calling some code and then you're the next step over is like the caller is like what would the caller expect, right? It's like
Yeah, I was going to say one more thing on the testing thing on changing how you write code. That was also something that I picked up from Lucho as well. I hope he ends up listening to this, but he always said to test the documentation, and I you know it was another thing that he would have to talk me into. I was like, oh, I don't know about that, but they truly are. Like I find myself learning how certain libraries work through their tests now because you can see exactly how they operate or exactly when they're called, and you can see how they modify values and what they're tested for, which will show you this is what the developer expected out of this thing. So they do end up being a pretty interesting way to document your software.
What else did Lucho, any other wisdom?
He tried to teach me Docker. He tried to teach me Docker, I think twice. Didn't get anywhere with that. I'm on my third attempt at learning Docker, and I finally think I get it. But the first two times, they just didn't go anywhere. And I'd pair with him, and I'd sit down, and he'd show me, and it looked so easy and so straightforward. And I would try to do what I wanted to do. It just was not happening, you know. It just was not happening. But I think I've tried it every year until I picked it up, and I finally got that. Lucio was a total polyglot. He was able to write, you know, Ruby and Java. He wrote our Android stuff. He'd pick up PHP stuff. And actually, that was another thing I learned from him. He on the SDKs team, you're reviewing PRs in languages that you don't write in. So the code really has to be written in a understandable, non-clever way. That's a big part of it. But also you find yourself reviewing for, you know, clarity, which it's helpful. You know, I was reviewing .NET PRs. I don't really know how .NET works, but in some cases, you would read something, and you know, he would ask questions on a PR that wasn't pointing at things that I was doing wrong. He was saying, "Hey, how does PHP handle that?" Or, "What is PHP doing in the background?" And he was just curious. You know, he was just curious about how the language worked or how the built-in function worked. And what I found was, first of all, is a kind of an interesting way to sort of cross-learn stuff and to write it for people that aren't really in depth with it. But it's also having me explain that back to him. I ended up rewriting parts of stuff because not just out of clarity, but he'd make me go and look back, you know, unintentionally to, oh, what is the documentation for that function? You know, I've written that function 700 times in the last 2 years, but let's look a little closer at this parameter, and you see, oh, you can actually pass in an option and take some of that logic out. It'll do that for you. You know, the core API will do that for you. And I try to do that too in PRs that I review now. Is if I don't understand, I'll just ask, and I'll tag it like, what does this do? Not, you know, I don't want to nitpick at it. I just want to, hey, explain this to me. I'm just curious. And I thought that was a really interesting way to again, like, learn new stuff and also basically say to someone, is that implemented right? You know.
Yeah, and it kind of, I mean, in a way, like having that like makes the review process like more fun too, right? Because it's kind of like you get, you know, a dozen comments on a PR and if it's all criticism and this is terrible, I imagine
Yeah.
that's pretty like, I mean, that's just pretty demotivating sometimes. But like
Totally.
you go through and it's the, you know, like there's some of that where it's like necessary, and then it's like actually asking questions and like, oh, is this like a pattern we should use elsewhere, which I think you've raised on, I've seen you raise a few times. It's like, yeah, it's thoughtful, which is cool. How do you maintain that? Like, how do you, because like it's easy to, if you're doing a code review, I'm just going on to code reviews now, because I think that's interesting. Because like I either have a tendency to like just be, I don't want to review it because I don't want to, like, I guess not that I don't want to offend anybody, but like I don't want to be too opinionated because I tend to like lean towards this idea of like, you know, it's like more of like a group pool, and like if I assert my opinions on other people, like that's gonna force them to like act a certain way, or like, you know, not to, sorry. So I guess there's the one hand where you can be too opinionated, and then there's the one hand where you're just like you don't do enough, and then you don't catch things. How do you keep those your code reviews so like thoughtful and like helpful?
Well, thank you.
Because they
You're
are.
very kind to say that. Well, there's so much, oh gosh, there's so much wrapped up in that. First of all, I try very hard on PR reviews, not just to read every line and like find every little thing, but I think there's so much psychology and sociology wrapped in that. That I think someone could write a book about that. You know, you and I don't know each other that well personally, but I'm going to come in and tell you things that you might have done wrong in something that's so important to you, like your work is very important to you, and I'm going to come in and say, you might have done these things wrong. Like, what a strange like situation to be in, and yet so necessary. I read a lot about sort of the personal side of that. So we're going to find bugs and problems in PRs. That's just how it goes. You might be writing something where the part of Auth0, I just know it better, and that's helpful. But I don't come into it thinking I'm a better engineer, and because I'm the lead, and so I have to show Matthew what he's doing wrong. I see it much more like, first of all, learning. I see PR review, pull request reviews is a huge amount of learning for me. So I'm reading it to understand it. I'm reading it so I understand when I come back in later and I have to add something or change something or whatever in the future that I'm like, oh, I think I might have seen that before. For React stuff and UI stuff, I'm again learning about how it all works. I try extremely hard not to nitpick on anything. I don't want to comment on variable names. I don't want to comment on spacing. That just drags everybody down, and it makes it really hard to read. I mean, if I'm reading for that level of granularity, how much value are we getting out of that, right? So I read for that, and I try to, if I find things, I also like to find things that are good, because it's often that you'd read good code in someone's PR. It's more often that you read good code in a PR. And it's kind of cool to say, hey, that's nice. That's implementation's really clear, or I'm really glad we fixed that, or that totally makes sense. That's super clear. I try to put those in there too, because I have both reactions reading through. It's like, maybe that's something, but that's really good too. And I think if you have it in your mind, like, you're not reading code, you're reading another person's work. That gets lost. We all think that, like, ooh, really narrow down and find all those little tiny bugs and all those little problems because we want our code to be so good. That only goes so far, and we only have so much time to read in depth, that in depth. I think you can correct for a lot of that stuff with PR size. Like, it's so much easier to read shorter PRs, and so it's easy to find the problems in there and find good implementation as well. But I really see it like, Matthew brought this, he wrote it, he read it, he tested it, he linted it. You worked hard on that thing. You might have put 2 straight days on this thing, and here I come and like, boo, that variable name is a little too long, or I don't know if that really makes sense. Maybe that line should go above there. I just try to be careful around that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I like the point about leaving like positive feedback as well. Like, I think I need to do that more because it just makes it, like I was saying, like it makes it engaging. Like it's enjoyable to engage in PRs instead of it being like, oh, I've already done the work. And now it's just like a thing you've got to get through. It's like it doesn't have to be. Yeah, so I think like my takeaway from that is just like I want to learn to enjoy like the process of like reviewing people's code or even having my code reviewed more. Like I think that's something that is it's yeah, it feels weird, but it's like it's inherently useful and it's necessary and like it doesn't have to be like a dirty or like a difficult or it's not an arduous thing. Like it's a good thing.
Yeah, totally. It really can be. And I think if pull requests are very painful for a lot of people on the team, I think that ends up being a team agreement type thing. Like, we need to take a step back and say, are we going to nitpick? And if we nitpick, we should flag it or something. I used to do that. I realized that a lot of my comments on my last team were kind of nitpicky, and so I would put nit in the comment, and that just meant take it or leave it. But then I thought, if it's take it or leave it out. Just leave it out of there. If it doesn't really matter, if it's not going to block merging it, and it's not going to really improve understanding or anything like that, like, how hard is it to come back and rename it later? Now, if it's like a whole set of, say, public APIs or something, or you really find something hard to like parse, I sometimes I just put that. Like, I don't know if it's me or not, but this is kind of hard to follow. Not a blocker, I'll prove it anyways. But yeah, that kind of stuff I think is really important. And I think a lot of that came from, on the open source, the SDKs team I was on, we just did PRs all the time. You'd read 2 or 3 a day. It was just part of, I mean, it must have been 20% of our work is reading PRs. So you really have to find a balance between I got to get through these things, and I do want to find, potentially, especially on public API changes or adding a new method that you can't change later or hard to change later. You really got to find that balance.
Sometimes I do like appreciate the nit and then like whatever, but I almost
Yeah.
feel like it. What I appreciate about it is that it's you specifically calling out that it's not like a blocker. So then like the things that are blockers are like like some people or I used to have teammate. I've had teammates in the past, or I've even probably done this unintentionally. It's not like a pointy thing, like going into a PR and then like leaving a comment that's very clearly like not like an absolute necessity, and then requesting changes so that it blocks anyone else from approving that PR, which it's like I've had yeah, so I could tell you some stories about stuff like that, and it just like especially if you're like not directly in the same room, like if a coworker did that and like you're in the same room. Actually, that's an interesting thing. So okay, so my point being, sorry, not to just immediately jump off, but
Sure.
the point was like, like if you're in the same room, then you could go across the office and be like, "Hey man, like or hey, like I saw this like request, like what's the intention here?" It's a little bit more awkward to do that like on a remote setting, I feel like. And maybe it really isn't. But it just feels that way sometimes, a little bit more personal, a little bit more direct, like DM somebody or even like at them in the channel. Have you like dealt with that? Like how have you dealt with that rather? Because I mean, you've been working at a fully remote company for 3 years, so.
I'm fascinated by this stuff. So I've been remote for 13 or 14 years at this point. I've been remote for my whole engineering career at least. And I've seen a lot of those, I was going to say missteps, but really confusion on the right way to communicate that kind of stuff. And some of it comes down to preference, right? I find like in a PR review, I consider a, like Confluence document or anything that's a truly a document like that as being a record. And I see things like Slack as being more of like side channel stuff. So I back on the SDKs team, maybe probably on this team every once in a while too, is you might put a few comments on there, but if you think like this is going to be really hard to hash out over 3 hour spaces overnight over here, let's just get this done on Slack and then we don't have all the back and forth in the comments. Or if you get a sense like this might be taken the wrong way, or if you get a sense something I've said has already been taken the wrong way. Often I'll put it into chat and just fill it full of emojis, right? It's just to say this is super lightweight that might have come across the wrong way. But I think word choice is really important to consider. And sometimes on PR reviews, I find myself a little more like straight-laced, I guess, less words, try to keep it terse. Someone's going to read this quickly. I want to be clear and concise. And it might come across as maybe hard-nosed. And I've often just DM somebody like, hey, there's a couple things in there. Let me know if you want to chat about it. Smiley face, sun emoji, alien robot. I don't know. But yeah, I think you kind of have to be careful. And but you at, on the same on the other side of that coin, you can't be so careful that you are immobilized because you don't get anything done. And you also it's hard to tell, you can try really hard to pick words and someone could still read it wrong, especially in a global company like ours. Across cultures, it's very difficult to say. Like, I could say this a certain way and someone could take it differently. I could be direct and someone could take it like, Jesus guy, who does he think he is? So I find you gotta be careful but not too careful. You can't be paralyzed by it. And you can always, I think you can always repair too after the fact.
Yeah, I like that. Like, it's not because it's easy to like wind up in like tragedy mode, I guess. Like, something goes wrong, and then because there's like the whole side of things where it's like, oh, like it's fine. Like, it'll all work out. There's no problem. People understand. And then there's there's the genuine case where it's gonna be like, I was a bit of, or I didn't mean to be a jerk, but I was a jerk, and now, like, this is the situation. I think like my immediate like I was as like a anxious person, like I and I'm sure like a lot of people listening or anybody really is probably very anxious, especially nowadays, but like it's the immediate response is like, I've just ruined this relationship. I don't know what to do. And then how do you deal with
I guess
that?
it's rarely that. Yeah, I would imagine it's rarely that bad. I make sure that my intentions are good because sometimes maybe I'm in a bad place, or I have definitely slacked with people, or like just if I just had a thing, my daughter freaked out on something, and I come up here and I'm in front of Slack and I'm like, I'm not feeling very friendly right now, So I have to kind of watch myself on that. But I know if my intentions are good and if I'm careful enough, that it usually comes off the right way. And then if it didn't, it's kind of easy to tell down the road, like something might be up, and you can kind of get at it. I think these are really hard questions because it's hard to do that asynchronously, toneless communication. It's tough, and you kind of just have to get used to it, and you find, you kind of get into a rhythm, and you figure out what people like, and we figure out, we start to learn each other, and as we work together. And sometimes, like you do the thing where you've DM'd me a couple of times and said, I hope that didn't come across this certain way. There's nothing wrong with that. I've definitely done the same thing. If you want to be careful and you care about people's feelings, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And it feels like you really care, like that the relationship is good. I think that's a great way to do it. I've done the same thing myself. Like, hey, I don't know if that went off so well, or after a meeting or something. I might have come across as harsh. That's really not how I felt. It seems like that's a great way to diffuse even potential problems.
Yeah, it's nice to know that, or it's okay to be human, right? We're all
Oh,
just people
yeah.
trying to do the same thing. So, I think in engineering, it feels like sometimes there's this strictness or sturdiness or robustness to everything, right? And so sometimes I feel like it's
Yeah.
easy to then take that and apply it to personal relationships too, because it's a professional relationship. I want to stay professional. It doesn't. There's just that human side of things. And it's hard to mesh those two sometimes, but it isn't really.
Well, it's vulnerability. It's always vulnerability, right? Like you can put yourself out there and someone could make you feel like, oh, you shouldn't have done that, So you always take a risk at doing that. But I have found, at least personally, I've thought a lot about this and journaled about it and all the other exploration methods. But if you put yourself out there and you're shot down, that's a great indication that it's not somebody that you really want a relationship with. Not to get too deep on the personal side, but I think that's key. And if you find that at work too, as like, okay, that person is has their professional line drawn. Now I know, but I don't think I've ever. I can't look back to a time where I've been vulnerable with somebody and really felt like, gosh, it was a mistake to show them who I really was. I might have gotten spurned some way, either professionally or, I can think of a time when I said something really offhanded about religion to somebody, and they were religious, but I didn't know that they had been taking it very seriously. And so I said something that was just really, it was just a really careless comment, and to a couple. And the guy said, like, really? Like he was immediately offended. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. And I came back later and I apologized to him. I said, that was really careless. I'm sorry that I don't know why that came out of my mouth. And we had a really good moment. Like we really connected and everything else. And then to the woman in the couple, I said the same thing at a different time. I was like, hey, I'm really sorry. He's, oh, no worries. I'm like, okay, but that was really heartless and careless. And no, it's fine. And I'm like, okay, I can't tell if it's really fine or. So I like you learn, like he was open to that vulnerable moment. She might not have been, or she was so offended that she was afraid she was going to yell at me or something. And it's like, okay, so I guess I'd have to be careful. But I wasn't sad that I put myself out there because I knew I needed to apologize for this, regardless of what someone else does with it.
You mentioned journaling, and I know that you write a lot. You write a lot at work, and then you write a lot in your personal life. And you mentioned to me before about how writing kind of helps you think through problems. And then I'm curious, how has writing affected your career development and just in general,
I have a lot of thoughts about writing. I would say it's been quite beneficial for me professionally, but only accidentally. I don't think I could have forced myself to write as much as I do if I thought there was a benefit, if that makes sense. Like I don't write for the outcome of other people reading it. I write because I like kind of have to. Like that's how I form my thoughts. That's how I communicate much better in writing, I think, you know, keeping things concise, keeping, you know, picking words and things like that. But I have found it's been, you know, really, really useful for me in so many ways. Like journaling for me is very, very important. I write, you know, long letters to my kids that I'll probably give them when they grow older. I write about anxiety. I write about anxiety and anxiety. Most of that stuff I don't publish. It's all just, you know, personal, just getting the stuff out. I write sort of like check-ins, you know, and then I use Day One, which is a journaling iOS journaling app, and it does this cool thing where it every time you go into the app, it'll show you know, everything you've written on the same day, however many years ago. And so you kind of get exposed to like, you know, journal entries from 7 years ago. And what I found is like 7 years ago, it's like I have some of the same anxieties as I do now. Like they never went away, you know. All this journaling and all this thinking, and it didn't help at all. But I definitely journal out of just sort of mental healthiness. It just helps. But I take a lot of notes. I use Roam, just incidentally. I know a lot of people are really into Roam. I think it's a cool tool that's, you know, it doesn't really matter what it is, but I do like that it's bullet points. So you might have seen I take a lot of meeting notes. I think those are super important. When I'm thinking through stuff, I'm always taking notes. If I'm troubleshooting, I'm usually taking notes. If I'm building something, I'm often taking notes. It's some way for me to put it, to take what I've just experienced a second ago or thought about, and then make sure it express it, and it solidifies it. And I think a lot of that has to do with I have a really bad memory in general. I find that like I'll watch a movie and a year later someone's like, "Oh, have you seen that movie?" And I'll say, "No." And it's like my wife is like, "Yeah, you did. We saw it together a year ago." Oh, I just don't remember it at all. So I find if I don't write it down, it's not even coming back to it later. It's just the act of writing it really helps me. But I've also found it really, you know, I've written up, you know, notes for talks from people. That's been helpful for them. I've written up, you know, my experience using features at Auth0 and sent it to the teams, and that was really, they were like, "Oh, thank you for this feedback." I find it's just for me default taking it down, and then I decide after a day or so, is this useful? You know, if it's meeting notes, I just move it to Confluence. If it's, you know, talk notes, move it over somewhere else. If it's oftentimes it'll become a blog post. Sometimes I just copy and paste it in a journal, you know, a snippet in time. So yeah, it's really critical for me.
Sounds like you have a lot of journaling mechanisms. Like you've got the Roam, you've got the Day One, you've got a personal journal. I'm assuming you probably do some writing on your blog and like also on Confluence. But how do you choose the medium? I guess do you have like a few defaults that you go to and then.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. I'd love to write a book about asynchronous communication or, you know, something in that realm. I feel like I have a fair amount to say about it, but I have sort of an idea of, you know, if I'm writing, if it's a journal, it's private. I know I'm not going to publish it. It's just something that's on my mind. So maybe I write about my last meditation session, or I'll write about conflict with the kids, or just write about something. I just need to get it out, right? So that's always going to be in my journal. It's hidden, no one sees it. If it's anything that I would ever like, anything at work or anything that I would, it might have a chance of being public. It always starts in Roam or whatever my note-taking app I'm using, just because it's very simple to put it in one space. Bullet points just help me, you know, sort of organize thoughts. I think in Markdown, so you end up markdowning it, and then after that, you kind of decide, you know, is this helpful? You know, you've seen probably many docs that I've written that have started out as bullet points and maybe have stayed as bullet points. You know, meeting notes are just a bunch of bullet points. It's because I copy them out, put them in, format them, link them, and it's out. So I find if I'm writing that way, it's much easier to flesh it out later if I need to. Sometimes it needs it, sometimes it doesn't, but usually where it goes is pretty clear. And if it doesn't, it just goes in sort of the general one, and I'll end up copying and pasting it. So I'll write it in Roam, and I'll copy and paste it in Slack, or I'll copy and paste it in Confluence, and then it lives there for as long as it needs to. But I'll have some sort of record of that if I have to go back and say, "Oh, what did I do, you know, those last few days?" Or, you know, "What was I doing in 2020? You know, what happened that year? I don't, something happened. I don't know. I don't remember."
Do you ever go back? Like, do you often go back and like reread? Like, I've found, so I've got probably like a dozen or so like random
Oh,
notebooks that I've
wow.
had over the year. Yeah, I just keep them, everywhere I went. Like I was at one point I was like homeless in Thailand, and I still insisted on like spending a few dollars on or having a notebook with me. But
that's great though. You're a committed writer.
So all those books, like I love going back over them sometimes. Like I never thought I would, do you ever like read back over?
Yeah, I have reread posts. I'll reread old. I read old journal entries pretty regularly because of that discovery feature of day one. I used to use Instagram a fair amount just to kind of document the kids and food and everything else. And I loved scrolling back through the photos. I had, you know, family and friends. I wasn't trying to be popular or anything on there, but I just loved scrolling back and seeing what the really good moments were. That's what I loved about Instagram when I was using it, is it because of those filters, it gave you like the feeling of what that moment was, and like scrolling back through and seeing these old kids' photos in these really specific moments that I felt were really fun and interesting. And I deleted that, but I exported everything and imported it into day one. And so now I can scroll back and see all these photos from then. And I'll go back and like type up sort of a memory from that time. So if it's like one of the kids and it's like, we were somewhere, and I'm like, oh, okay, I'll type that up and I'll tag it. So then I can give them that when they're older and say, here's just years and years and years of what we did and who you were and what you look like. And so, yeah, I go back a lot. I also reread those old anxious posts to make sure I'm not, you know, staying in the same cycle over and over and over again. Because, boy, I've definitely written some recently and gone back and it's like you could have taken this journal entry and passed it through, you know, whatever GPT or whatever the machine learning thing is, and it would create this one exactly the same, you know, same feeling, same thought, and you know, 7 years later. So yeah, I like to do that. And I read old blog posts sometimes. I've been blogging since 2008. So I've got some, you know, really gung-ho, here's how you do SEO and here's how to hire a designer. And, you know, it's like, oh, I was so, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed back then. And, you know, just blogging weekly about, you know, web development and web design. And meanwhile, I knew like this tiny sliver of what was going on in that realm. So
I have so many blog posts that I wrote when I first started first started working that like I wish I'd posted them, because like it was super like, I mean, I couldn't post it now because it's like so cocky and it would it's like blatantly wrong, you know, but it would be so yeah. Cool to be able to like point back to that, because it's like, you know, it would be consistent. I like that. Like I really love that. Has a lot come out of the blogging, or do you just do it for personal, like note-taking, like you said, like to retain information, like form a narrative and think through things, I guess?
Yeah, I get a fair number of visits on there. I used to have it, I had it on WordPress until last year, because everything was on WordPress that I built for a long time. And what I thought was really interesting is I would get comments every now and then that from people on, you know, I've written about, you know, going to school, being older, and I've written about, how to price your services and things like that. And you get these really kind of heartfelt comments from people saying like, gosh, I thank you so much for writing this. This is really good to read. Not tons, you know, I'd get like one a month maybe. And that was fun. I kind of miss that now that I'm on a static site. But I think in general, I like putting that stuff out there because it feels, in some cases, I really want to say something. So I wrote something about meditation, and I'll end up sending it individually to people. I'll send it to my cousin who I talked to about meditation. I'll send it to Cam on our team because we talked about meditation. Or I'll just write it because I have one on WordPress unit testing. I wrote it last year when I wasn't doing any WordPress unit testing, but I had this whole framework and code and things that I really wanted to put out there. So it's just like, you know what? I don't want this knowledge just in my head. It should be out there. And if people use it, wonderful. Hopefully a few people will see it. It was fun to write it. You know, it shows my path. That's great. But I think the most beneficial writing I ever did was, you know, blog posts for products that I built, or I never really got a lot of direct, like when I was freelance, not a lot of direct business through blogging. That was like 95% word of mouth referral stuff.
In terms of like getting something out of it, I think like that meditation post alone, like definitely impactful. Like I feel like you mentioned, like Cam probably really benefited from that. I read that and I was like, oh, cool. Like I started meditating off of like a tweet of yours about the waking up
Oh,
app.
nice.
Yeah, like I like I so yeah, like you've definitely changed some lives as a result, like
Good to
in some
hear. Well,
small
if you
way
get
or
into
big way.
WordPress, if
All
you get into
right,
WordPress, I'll, go back through the archives. Go through the
well.
WordPress tag. Just stop at like 3 years ago and before. Everything before that. Don't follow any of
Okay.
that.
Cool. Read the very. I'll just go in chronological order up through your posts and see where it like yeah. I'll just map out this. I don't know. I will
Cool.
not do that. That'll be weird.
Please don't. I've been meaning to. I use 11D for blogging, and they have all these like great functions and plugins and stuff. And what I really want to do is a total word count for the whole blog. I still have. I'd love to get that calculation. Like, I mean, it's got to be at least a book's length. No one would read this disparate, crazy, rambling thoughts from all over the place. I'm just curious, how much is it? And then how much is like if you printed that out, how big would that be?
That would be so cool.
I don't know. Yeah. Next project. Next project.
It's funny, like I have web developer, but my website is like a template that I just never finished because I was like
Oh
always
yeah.
focused on something else.
That's how it goes. That's how it goes. I went kind of nuts this last year, and I was really sick of logging to WordPress, and I just switched teams to the one that we're on together now, off of the SDKs team, and I was like, I'd really like to just be truly done with WordPress. I've been saying for years, I love the platform. I think it's amazing. I don't want to talk down about it. I think it's a great platform for content management. It's fantastic. But I didn't have any need for it anymore. Didn't have any clients. I blog in Markdown. I don't want a Markdown editor that then converts it. And you go in and plugins and updates and everything else. I'm like, I want something really clean. And it turns out like switching it over to this process Markdown, changes are so fast and writing is so fast. I wrote way more last year than the other 2 or 3 years before that because it was just so simple and it's in plain text and it's really easy to tinker with the theme and stuff. So that was a really good benefit for me is having a writing system that I really felt good in and really wanted to write in. And even using it on GitHub is like such a nice, all the stuff is open source on GitHub and you can make corrections like you did, which is awesome.
It was funny because it was a post about meditation and I saw that one point and I it was such a I think like I was fixated on it and then I was like whatever I'll move on and then the next post was something I can't remember what it was but my thought process was like okay I need to like learn from this moment and take in the point of the post and then also I'm gonna post a PR anyways because that's just why not just be that
Yeah.
guy. But yeah, I think it's
Oh, I
really
appreciate
cool.
it.
I feel like there's a lot more we could talk about, but it's
Yeah, I'd be happy to do this again
yeah.
if you have more to explore. I've been writing a ton about, like I said, asynchronous communication and just kind of like gathering my thoughts in Rome, which actually is
Yeah.
working pretty nicely for that. So I'd love to talk about that or
Would you be down to do like an entire episode that's just like Josh's 101 on async communication? Like I was thinking of something like that, like
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I like I said, I have a lot of thoughts about it, and it feels like it's like congealing recently. So yeah, I'd love to talk through that.
we could do like a whole other hour. It would be great.
Awesome. Let's start our own podcast just on that.
Maybe. I would listen to that. Like I need to listen to that. I
Yeah,
need
totally.
to
That'd be great. Cool. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I need to go pick up pizza, but it's really fun to talk to you and get to know you a little better. Awesome. Well, I'll see you online tomorrow.
Yeah, will do. See you tomorrow.
Awesome.
Take care.
Take care.